from WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New FBI warnings this week of possible suicide bomber attacks on U.S. soil. Americans have come to fear the angry edge of the Arab world and maybe Islam. Muslim American writer Asma Gul Hassan looks beyond the disturbing images of war to embrace her God and country. Tonight on Point, an American Muslim looks at Islam and the world now. But first, beyond the high-profile court-martial of a low-level army trooper, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal has been growing in scope this week. A flurry of investigative reports have focused on who knew what when and who ordered what when up the military chain of command. Adding fuel to the fire, more graphic photos and video footage of debasing brutality were made public today by the Washington Post. Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate.com. I asked him where the Abu Ghraib investigations appear to be headed next.
I think all eyes are upward. The question that's being asked by the Senate Armed Services Committee, including Republican leaders on the committee, and by every newspaper editor and national security reporter in the country trying to follow up on the revelations by Seymour Hersh and The New Yorker and Michael Iskoff and others in Newsweek, is how high up does it go? It's becoming quite clear that these seven guys in Abu Ghraib prison didn't come up with this by themselves, that they were encouraged by military intelligence, that similar things were going on at other prisons that the people at Abu Ghraib couldn't have known anything about. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that Bush knew at least the rough edges of this, that Rumsfeld knew about it, that undersecretaries of his knew about it. It's going to become a huge political tsunami over the next several weeks and months as the rope to the top is climbed higher and higher, inch by inch, leak by leak.
Fred, paint that picture of what the evidence points to so far in a bit more detail. As you say, the editors will be in full lather here and the knives are out all over Washington. Given what's been reported so far, what's the general roadmap they're going to be following? What's the case that seems to be emerging?
There's a pre and a post. You know, the post is, it's now been said by Secretary of State Colin Powell on the record that he told President Bush about these Red Cross reports about what was going on, not in great detail, but in general terms. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld also knew about it. The Seymour Hersh story claims that Rumsfeld, who had been allowing much more aggressive interrogation techniques in Guantanamo, where al-Qaeda suspects were being held, and apparently, according to Hersh, these techniques worked. We were getting good information about terrorist operations. You know, the war is over in Iraq. A lot of people are rounded up. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Who are these insurgents who are attacking our forces? Nothing's coming out of it. So he sends the same guy who was operating Guantanamo to go turn Abu Ghraib into an interrogation center.
And not just the same guy, but with the same sort of marching orders.
That's exactly.
Get tough, do what it takes.
That's right. So, okay, maybe they didn't know specifically that some guy would be stripped naked and have dogs surrounding him. But there were certain things in general that they did authorize happening, including sexual humiliation, sleep deprivation, things that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions. An exception was made, you know, a legal exception was made, an opinion was rendered that Geneva did not apply to al-Qaeda suspects.
And here we had Alberto Gonzalez, the White House counsel, calling Geneva Conventions obsolete and quaint in relation to those prisoners.
Quaint. That's right. And let's say that that's legitimate. I don't want to get into that, but let's say that it is. It doesn't apply. That reasoning would not apply to conventional prisoners of war in Iraq. There wasn't even a pretense that they had time urgent, as they say, information about terrorist operations that might affect the United States.
So if this was the key that was turned, then fill in the rungs in the ladder. If Donald Rumsfeld said, all right, let's do this in Iraq, who would be the links in the chain of command who might be implicated here, Fred?
Well, Stephen Cambone, who's the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, who was the point man in the Pentagon for all these kinds of operations.
Who we saw testifying alongside General Taguba and generally denying misdeeds.
And I think if what Hersh and Newsweek report is true, turns out to be true, and documented, you know, it's not inconceivable that Cambone could face perjury charges. He testified under oath.
Who else?
Well, you know, as you go down the road, there's the whole chain of command. Cambone told Lieutenant General William Boykin to go down to Guantanamo. Boykin, you remember, is the very controversial figure who once gave a sermon in a church saying that this was a war of Christians against Islams and our God is better than their God, you know. I mean, something like that. The guy should have been fired, but he's been Cambone's military deputy. So he goes down to Guantanamo, instructs General Jeffrey Miller, who'd been executing the program there, to take it to Iraq. Miller told Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who was in charge of the 800th Military Brigade,
right,
you know, she's already been implicated, and it goes up and down the chain of command.
So how would an investigation into this chain of command proceed? Who's going to launch it? How are they likely, or are they likely, to try and bring this out, or is there a stonewall being put up here?
Well, the Senate Armed Services Committee has said, you know, the Republican-controlled Senate Armed Services Committee, that they are not going to stop this inquiry until they get to the bottom of it. The Justice Department has opened up investigations into, I've read, somewhere between 3 and 5 interrogation-related deaths. So, I mean, there could be homicide charges going on here. There are independent organizations looking into charges of war crimes. And see, what happens if one investigation uncovers some very incriminating information, deals can then be made.
Along the same lines as with low man Jeremy Civits. Give us
right.
what you know and
or
implicate Watergate. The others.
You know, Watergate, you know, John Dean. You know, you get one guy, you give him a good shake if he implicates other people. This is how reporters work. This is how prosecutors work. I think, Bush could put up a good stonewall. That's obviously what he's trying to do. Maybe it'll work. But we could be seeing just the beginning of this, really.
And as you say, the knives are out, and out surprisingly in both parties. And lest we forget, the evidence of this abuse continues to come out as well. More photographs today, Fred, in the Washington Post. Really disturbing photographs.
Also, the other place where the knives are out are within the long-standing internecine feuds between the military and the Pentagon and the military and the CIA and the Pentagon. They've all been trying to encroach on one another's territory on these kinds of issues and all sorts of defense-related issues. Coats could turn, so to speak, in those arenas as well.
Coats turning, scores to be settled here. It sounds like a lot more to come. Fred Kaplan, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate.com. He spoke with me from New York. In her new book, Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey, Muslim-American writer Asma Gul Hassan describes an Islam whose values are essentially those of American society. She rejects the Islam of Osama bin Laden and Al Jazeera. Equality, the quest for self-improvement, democracy, even feminism, all flow, she says, from the Islam she practices. Skeptics have suggested the 29-year-old Chicago-born daughter of Pakistani immigrants is embracing just what appeals to her liberal sensibilities, but hers might be the future of Islam in America. We can hope and also probe. Tonight on Point, a young American's vision of Islam. Is the United States in a clash of civilizations with Islam? Does it need to be? 3 years after 9/11 and a year into Iraq, what's your attitude toward Islam? What impresses you? What mystifies you? What disturbs you? Can we all just get along? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Asma Gul Hassan. Her new book is Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey. She's also author of American Muslims, the New Generation. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Denver Post. And later in the hour, we'll be joined by Leila Ahmed, professor of women's studies in religion at the Harvard Divinity School. But first, a very good evening and welcome to you, Asma Gul Hassan.
Thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for being with us. It's great to have you. Thanks for the book and for sharing your insights so frankly and candidly. There's so much we want to hear tonight about how your interpretation, your vision, your understanding of Islam compares with this flood of images and ideas that Americans are getting. But let me just first go to some of the things in the news that everyone's been seeing and ask how they're hitting you. And just in the last 10 days, it's been unbelievable. The images from Abu Ghraib, the images of Nicholas Berg's horrible beheading with his killer shouting praise to Allah or words to that effect as he did it. The fresh images just today in the Washington Post. First the Abu Ghraib and the Washington Post images and the rest. With the added twist in the Washington Post release today, images and news coming out of Iraqi prisoners being asked to do things clearly against Islam, to kind of renounce Islam or appeal to Jesus. I mean, how are you absorbing this as a young American Muslim?
Well, in some ways, it's unbelievable, just like it is for all of us as Americans, you know. As if there was anything that could make the Abu Ghraib photos seem not as shocking, then we have this beheading, you know. It's just been stunning. To some degree, as an American Muslim who grew up in the United States, my whole life, even before 9/11, I've been explaining Islam to people, talking about Islam. This book that we're talking about now, Why I Am a Muslim, it only took me a month to write. And people are always like, wow, it only took you a month.
Because you're just so loaded with it. You're
right,
so primed.
I've been talking about it all my life. I mean, really, I've been waiting to write the book for a long, long time. So we've all been doing these, you know, as Muslims, we've all been talking about Islam constantly. But since 9/11, there's been a sense of urgency with it. And as Americans, we are representing our faith to our fellow Americans. We are ambassadors of Islam to those who are not Muslim here in the United States, which is the majority of the country. To fellow Muslims around the world, we're representing America and American policies. Many of us are immigrant background. We have parents like mine who emigrated or emigrated ourselves.
Pakistan in your case.
Pakistan in my case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my parents have friends. I have family there. And they're asking us, what's going on with America? And we're in America and people are asking me, what's going on with Muslims?
When you ask yourself what's going on with America and you look at these images as a young American Muslim, you're an attorney. You're good with words, but answer this question if you would. How do you respond? What are you thinking to yourself about what you see? Does the kind of sunny optimism, and not uncheckered, but the optimism of your book hold up under this rain of images and blows?
It does, but it is stunning. The thing about the photographs, there's so many things that, you know, bother me and everyone else. But, you know, Al-Qaeda, nobody elected Al-Qaeda Islam's military. You know, they're their self-elected, self-propelled. Mm-hmm. Where to see my own military that I'm so proud of, to see individuals who obviously, you know, are misguided and
US
don't
soldiers.
Represent all, but it really hurts me. And, you know, when you think about, you know, even if the people in those photos are guilty, you know, we're America. You know, we're not Al-Qaeda. You know, we should never use, sure, maybe Al-Qaeda beheads people or whatever horrible things they do, but we should never use that as a comparison. And that's how I feel about being Muslim also. I mean, we are supposed to be the best, you know. So it really does
stun me. The best
in
terms of?
In terms of being good, being kind. The Prophet Muhammad was a very kind individual, and he never shied away from any question. You know, anybody who would come to him with a question about whatever the topic, menstruation, birth control, he commented on those subjects, you know.
So when you see these images of American soldiers, does it look to you, in addition to soldiers run amok, we don't know how high up the chain of command, but do you also see an element of anti-Islamic behavior here or not?
Yes, because the thing that's about those photos is it's almost like they're uniquely designed to humiliate Muslims. Muslims, we have very high standards of hygiene. We have to cleanse ourselves five times a day in order to pray five times a day. Mm-hmm. We have these very strict standards of cleanliness. It's just those photos, I don't know if they disturb Americans as much as they disturb Muslims because Muslims are so particular about certain issues.
Do you fear, we've just got a few seconds, we'll come back to it, but do you fear a clash of civilizations if we don't get things back on some kind of even keel?
Well, certainly there are many people who would benefit from making it out that way. And I fear from the profiteers. I personally don't think that Islam and America are on a doomsday course with each other, but it's easy for someone to make it out that way.
We're talking tonight with Asma Ghul Hassan. Her new book is Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey. You can join our conversation. Is the United States in a clash of civilizations with Islam? Does it need to be? What's going on here? And what's your question for an enthusiastic young American Muslim who believes we can all get along? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Islam and America, Islam and the World, with Asma Gul Hassan. Her new book is Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey, One Young American Woman's, Muslim Woman's, American Muslim Woman's View of the World. You can join the conversation. Going on 3 years after 9/11 and a year into Iraq, what's your attitude toward Islam? What impresses you? What disturbs you? What mystifies you? Is the United States at risk of making an enemy of Islam by treating it as an enemy? Is there a real conflict here or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Asma Gul Hassan, I wish you would paint two pictures for us in brief. The picture of Islam that disturbs you, the picture of Islam that you see as the real Islam.
Well, the picture of Islam that disturbs me, the things that I would say, such as the beheading of Nicholas Berg, which was horrible and disgusting, those don't represent Islam to me. So I
fill out that picture, though, before you give us your view, and I know you've got a very positive one. I mean, I can fill in the blanks for you if need be. Maybe it's not what disturbs you. There's the kind of violence we see with Nicholas Berg.
And then there's the treatment of Muslim women in Islamic countries. That bothers me.
The view that this, it looks like, oh my gosh, how anti-woman can you be?
Mm-hmm.
The absence of democracies in a fair number of Islamic countries that makes people wonder, can Islam live, can a secular state and an Islamic state be the one and the same?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually on some of those things, we take a glass is half empty approach when we really could take glass is half full approach. I mean, there are Islamic countries that are democracies.
Certainly.
There's Senegal, which, is a growing democracy. Certainly it's not on the level that we're at, but look at our last election. I mean, no democracy is perfect.
But when the White House and most people look across the heart of the Islamic world, you do not see a lot of democracy.
But that's, in a way, that's how we paint it. I mean, that's how it's presented. If I could write you a paper that would have you convinced
that would say Egypt,
that Islam,
Saudi Arabia, Syria,
not
Yemen,
those countries, but other countries.
No, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm just saying, not to quibble, but there are kind of the big issues, the sense of Islam, the intolerant, Islam, the anti-woman,
mm-hmm.
Islam, skepticism about its potential to sustain democracy. What's the Islam that you see in opposition to those images, to that view?
Well, I often tell people about my visits to Pakistan, and unfortunately I haven't visited since 9/11, but my brother visited last summer, and he went to the inner city ghetto part of Lahore, mm-hmm. which is where my parents are from. And actually our family told him, don't go, you know, as an American you shouldn't go, even we don't go, as mm-hmm. you know, Pakistani people we don't go. But he said, no, I want to go and see, you know, this is what everybody talks about, that, you know, these are the people that are the extremists. And when he went there, the young children there asked him who he was and if he was an American. And he just said, you know, yes, I am an American. He wasn't ashamed of hiding that. And they all sort of flocked to him, and he thought they were just going to sort of attack him. But actually, as it turned out, they just wanted to meet him and wanted him to take their picture. He had a video camera, and they were very excited. And my parents always said when they were growing up in Pakistan that America to them stood for hope, for freedom. When they met young Americans, they thought they were the most optimistic, energetic people, and they wanted to be like them. And I was proud that my brother, to these young children who lived, ate, and slept in the same alleyways that they will probably die in, that to him, to them, he represented hope and represented possibly their own future. That, you know, there's this Pakistani-American boy who came here wearing blue jeans and had an expensive video camera.
So it can happen.
It can happen.
Out there to
and,
be tapped. But you know what else is out there? The towers came down in Manhattan.
I mean, we can't forget that most of the Muslim world is poor, doesn't have access to education, is hungry. You know, it's easy to say, okay, look, here's all the problems in the world. Muslims are behind most of them.
I'm not saying that. I'm just asking you to respond to these characterizations, to these understandings. Let's pick one up specifically. You're young and female. Islam is seen as unfriendly to women. Is that correct?
No, Islam is not unfriendly to women. It says in the Quran that the only difference God sees among us is our piety. Certainly, I wouldn't be Muslim if I thought that it held me back somehow as a woman. Unfortunately, in many Islamic countries, there is patriarchy, and patriarchy is one of the oldest things in the world. It has existed for a long time. Islam is about 1,400 years old. Patriarchy is older than Islam. Islam was able to eradicate some patriarchal practices, like female infanticide, for instance, but there's other practices that have existed before Islam that Islam is still striving to eliminate but have gotten caught up in tradition. Certainly here in America, I think we have discrimination and sexism, but those are not the ideals of America. We're always, as are Muslims, trying to achieve, you know, the best of our religion and the best of our system here in America.
Islam as a neighbor and fellow traveler on the planet, there's the notion that it is somehow inherently aggressive, that, you know, Islam is always pushing out at the edges. It's been written, the bloody edges of the Islamic world, always conflict there. Is it inherently somehow a threat, an aggressor?
No.
I mean, and this is bold to ask at a time when I have 150,000 American soldiers in Iraq. Nevertheless, we ask.
No, that's not true. I mean, there's over a billion Muslims in the world. About 1/6 of the world's population is Muslim. If it were true that every Muslim is out for blood and bloodthirsty, we would have much more terror than we already do.
But I don't mean every, but on balance, does it lean toward why?
No, no, of course not.
Why are the edges of Islam bloody then in the words of Samuel Huntington?
Well, I think Samuel Huntington is speaking in sort of intellectualisms and abstractions. Mm. I can tell you, as an American Muslim, I have no interest in killing non-Muslims. You know, it says that in the Quran that Jews and Christians are our brothers and sisters of the book, that anybody who does good acts and good deeds has nothing to fear on Judgment Day. You know, there's no, I don't have any, you know, anti, you know, any feeling against people who are not Muslim, you know, and that's silly to think.
I don't mean to personalize it in that way at all, but people, you know, just trying to make sense of what's really going
on
here.
I mean, think about, you know, in America, we've had these school shootings, you know, at various schools.
Yeah.
Somebody, an outside observer, it would be easy for them to say, you know, there's something in American culture that makes these young people go find guns and then come to their schools and shoot their classmates.
Would that be wrong to ask that question?
Well, I think it would be wrong. I mean, these were troubled children. They were having some kind of problem, and somewhere there was a breakdown in the system that someone didn't reach out to them. There's not anything in American culture that's sort of driving youth to, you know, engage in these school shootings. But it's easy. It's simple for us in looking at the Muslim world or an outside observer of America to want to sort of just band-aid it or paint the problem as it's just this one thing. If we could just cure the world of Islam, we wouldn't have any problems. I mean, look at the problems Muslims
are involved in. Oh, I don't think anybody's suggesting that yet, trying to figure out.
But what you were saying was sort of suggesting that you know, Islam is the bloody edge and, you know, I mean, I think what you were saying is a version of that, you know, but the problems Muslims are involved in are often about politics, about land, about political issues. If the Palestinians, for instance, let's say they were all Jewish or let's say they were all Christian, don't you think they'd still want their own country? Wouldn't they want to have their own freedom and their own independence?
So you're saying strip the religion out for a second and just look at circumstances on the ground. Asma Gul Hassan, you write that the Quran and the core values of American society are strikingly similar. What do you mean by that?
Well, by that I mean that certain values that are part of Islam are very important in American culture.
Such as?
For instance, when the Prophet Muhammad was dying on his deathbed, one of the things he said was to the community to choose a leader from amongst yourselves, to pick a leader. And the early Muslim community did for many years after his death. He could have easily installed a monarchy or a dynasty. He could have said, take my daughter or my cousin, make them the leader. But instead, he said, pick a leader. You must have a leader that you're invested in as a community. I think that's a very democratic gesture and probably one of the first times in recorded history that the leader of a movement was making a democratic stance and taking a democratic standard. And the early Muslims, to their credit, did follow that democratic stance for many years after his death. That's one example. For Muslims, we are obligated, as a matter of our religion, to donate a portion of income to charity. Usually it's about 2.5%. Sometimes it's as much as 10%.
Like tithing.
Similar to tithing. That is something that I think is an American value also, that you have to help out your fellow man, that your problems are important, but the problems of your neighbor are important too, and that we're all in this together. As Muslims, we are obligated to help out our fellow man. I think that as Americans, we should be excited and happy that there's over 6 million people in the United States who, as a matter of their religion, must give to charity, that they're required to. I think that's a value that's in common.
Yeah. You write that you say the Islam that I practice is not the one depicted by Osama bin Laden. We fully trust that. Or by Al Jazeera. And that made me wonder at that point. Al Jazeera is a very big, very widely distributed cable network in the Middle East. If the Islam you practice is not the one depicted by Al Jazeera, which millions of people watch and listen to and absorb attitudes from every day, then is the Islam that you practice relevant to this conversation, or is it yours in the cosseted, warm folds of America, not in the reality of the Middle East, where much of this conversation is unfolding on the ground in material terms?
Well, the American Muslim population is certainly unique in many respects. And in one respect that we're unique is that we are isolated from a lot of the political problems that the Islamic world is caught up in. So I would say that, I am lucky that I've grown up in the United States, that I've gotten away from the political problems that I would have probably been exposed to had my parents stayed in Pakistan. I've also am free from the cultural baggage that holds many Muslims down throughout the Islamic world. There are so many cultural practices that I, as a South Asian, engage in. That are very interesting, very fun. Some of them are also patriarchal and sexist. But as an American, I'm able to realize, hey, this has nothing to do with Islam. There is nothing in the Quran saying that I have to do this particular thing or that I have to have an arranged marriage. Those are things that I would do as a South Asian.
So you can separate it out and hold Islam up above, whether it's some fun South Asian traditions or some political situation in the Middle East, which is far from fun.
Right. I can say, it's okay for me to have this view as a South Asian, but this is not me being a Muslim. Being a Muslim is something else.
Asma Gul Hassan, it's great to have you with us. Stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation Leila Ahmed. She's professor of women's studies and religion at the Harvard Divinity School, author of A Border Passage from Cairo to America, A Woman's Journey. She's been with us before and always insightful. Leila Ahmed, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Pleasure.
We're reading this young American smart Muslim woman's book with great enthusiasm at one level. I mean, her passion for an Islam that just, as she says, sort of lines up so neatly and nicely with what we like to think of as American values makes it sound as though we can march into a bright future rather easily, but circumstances on the ground look so difficult. Is there, Asma Gul Hassan reaches into the Quran, finds messages that would be reassuring to anybody and wonderful to anybody, and says, this is Islam. We look out into the world and it doesn't seem so simple. How do we bridge this gap?
Well, let me go back to something that you said when you were asking her, is this your Islam? And she replied by saying, well, it is American Islam, because she's able to cast off cultural things. But actually, one of the best chapters, I thought, in this book was a chapter I think she called Sufism. And I think it's actually not about Sufism, which is a spiritual movement, but about
the mystical tradition of Islam.
Yes, mystical tradition. It's really about lived Islam. It's about the ordinary Islam, the ordinary oral tradition of how people live it and what ethical ideas that derive from it. And actually, in the course of that chapter, she talked about a great deal about her grandparents, what they did, what shrines they went to, how they practice Islam. So I think what she's doing is reinterpreting within the American context what has been a very, very long tradition, and in which the kinds of things that she talks about being taught to value other religions, well, after all, Muslims have grown up for centuries in societies which are multi-religious, have been multi-religious for centuries, whether with Christians and Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and so on. So I think this is a living tradition that she's tapping into, and it's unfortunately not visible in our media. So when you say that's not when we see, it's not what we see when we read our media or listen, but actually it's very much there, present there as a living reality in the way people live their lives and what the kind of values they're informed
within the world of Islam.
That's right. It's not, on the other hand, they're evident in our governments, which are, on the whole, pretty awful.
Then when you separate out the politics and the religion, if that's possible to do, and Lord knows that's very difficult to do, maybe impossible, but so much has been written since 9/11/01 about Islam. Are there fundamental conflicts that we ought to address, openly and honestly, and not just issues within Islam necessarily, but in the way that Islam meets the West, in the way that it meets modernity, in the way that it meets, Christianity or Judaism, that need discussion? Or is it just a matter of misinterpretation of Islam and for that matter, perhaps other religions as well? And once everyone becomes pure and true to the book, whichever book it is, we'll all be fine and sweet by and by.
That's a pretty tough question.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that.
But let me, okay, I think there isn't a I guess I'm not dividing the world. I don't see the world divided between Islam and the West or Islam and Christendom or any of those sort of things. I think there is something that has to be resolved between the fundamentalisms on all levels, whether in the West or in Islam. And I have nothing whatever in common, no more than Asma does, with Osama bin Laden or a whole variety of kinds of Islam that are alien to me here in America and were alien to me when I grew up as a child in Cairo. You know? So it's that construct that I really think we should question, that is the divide between
the whole
us.
Them and us, right. It and the other.
That's right, yes.
And yet the news every day keeps
That's
pushing
right.
it back
it does.
In our face.
It does,
I want to
yes.
turn to our callers. Ali is calling from Boston. Hi, Ali, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to basically touch upon the conversation we just had. That is, religion is basically interpretation of its individual. It's a very individualistic relationship between man and creator, supposed to be. But it's always been taken out of context depending on the circumstances that's being applied to. Look at Iran, Islamic Republic. And to a point, even U.S. is kind of going with that, maybe we should call Islamic Republic of Iraq or Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. So the spin of putting the politics added to this, it makes it even much more complicated than just saying, okay, Islam is, is it a clash of civilization or not? But I believe by creating a complex situation that we are going down that path, we will have a conflict with our civilizations.
And what about the image, the vision, the picture of Islam that Asma Gul Hassan projects here, Ali? Is it your Islam?
Unfortunately, no. I was born in Iran, raised in Iran, and I saw how they basically translated Islam for their advantage in the political process. But I do believe that because religion is an individual, it's a relationship between man and God, and it should be individualistic.
Yeah, but do you mean when you say you saw how they interpreted it, that you didn't see the same liberalism in Islam that Asma Gul Hassan is suggesting?
Oh, sure. They started it down that path in 1979, but within 6 months, they were holding prayers in the office of government buildings, just like, unfortunately, U.S. is kind of going down path. Also,
and do you link that then to Islam or to the particular political powers who came into power with the revolution there?
It's not Islam by itself, but the fact. Well, there are a couple of things. The fact that Iran is a Shiite country, and in Shiism, you're supposed to have a person that you follow. Maybe it's different. I'm not sure about Sunniism, but. That causes it the way you just explained. That is, when you follow a leader, and if your leader said, this is what you do, and that's your religion, then it becomes clash of civil.
We've got it. Ali, we've got to take a break, but thank you very much for your call. We'll come to this just after. We're talking tonight about Islam in America, Islam in the world. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Islam in America, Islam in the world. I'm joined by Asma Gul Hassan, young American Muslim woman. She's author of the new book, Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey, and also by Leila Ahmed, professor of women's studies in religion at the Harvard Divinity School. You can join the conversation as well. What about it? Do you take heart and find hope in Asma Gul Hassan's bright and beautiful view of Islam? Is this the new Islam, the true Islam, the future in the buoyant vision of a young American Muslim? Are you abashed even having the conversation while 150,000 U.S. soldiers, largely Christian, are in Iraq? Can we have 9/11, Abu Ghraib, and global religious harmony? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A lot of callers want to join us, but Asma Gul Hassan, first to you on Ali's comment before the break. Iranian saying, look, I saw something in that Islamic revolution that didn't look liberal to me. He lives in America now.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing to remember about Islamic countries in anything that Muslims do is just because a Muslim does it or because an Islamic country does it doesn't mean that it's Islam, doesn't mean that that's the best representative of the Quran and that they're following what the Quran says necessarily. Certainly, I would be the last person to, you know, defend Islamic countries. I think many Islamic countries like Saudi Arabia participate in activity that is very un-Islamic. Pakistani Muslims, when they go to visit Saudi Arabia, complain tremendously about how they're, you know, mistreated, not to mention, you know, how Christians are treated. So certainly if we look to Islamic countries as a model of Islamic behavior, we will always find them lacking.
Leila Ahmed, can the United States kind of settle down, simmer down a little bit, and trust that the Islamic world will gradually evolve toward democracies that have in common with the U.S., everything that democracies have in common?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by United States simmer down.
Right now we have a lot of soldiers in the Middle East, and one of the announced purposes is to, by force of arms, help roll democracy across that region.
Yeah.
Is that what it takes? Is there something about Islam that requires that? Or do you believe it would organically generate democracy without any intervention, without that kind of fisticuffs?
Unfortunately, the reason we don't have democracy is in part has been the result of intervention over the centuries.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, we have had democratic regime toppled, deliberately sabotaged.
By imperial powers.
By imperial power, by the British in Egypt in the 20s and 30s, by America, in Iran itself in the 50s. So I think there's something terribly false in our speaking about Islamic democracies as if they failed to happen because there's something intrinsic to Islam.
It ignores history.
Ignores history, tragically so, yes.
If it's possible to strip that away, as a student of Islam, are you confident that it evolves in that direction? Our caller Ali expressing some doubt.
Yes. I think certainly in the country that he mentioned and in Saudi Arabia, particular versions of Islam are very entrenched, and I don't know how they would be changed. I think it cannot happen without global. A world in which justice was honored and respect for all humanity was honored might be a very good starting point. But we need that first, and we need the collaboration of the world.
By all.
And we do need collaboration. I don't think they can, given where they are now, single-handedly achieve these democracies.
Let's take another call. Manaz is calling from Boston. Hi, Manaz. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Good evening.
My question was regarding to treatment of women in Islam. And there is no denial that polygamy is part of Islam. Also, there are laws such as two women testifying of two women is equivalent of one man, or even stoning of women if there is if they have an affair or thought of marriage and stuff like that. So I would like to know how does your guest reconciled with that. And is she sure that when you see so much of that in every Islamic country, is she sure that it's not her interpretation that is, different, or she's just trying to rationalize and justify that? And there's one more thing maybe I say, and then I get off.
Yeah.
And the other one, the other thing that I have a problem with that is a lot of harsh punishment in Islam, the fatwa, and I'm not sure if that's the right name, but if you cannot say, as a Muslim, you cannot say anything in Islam against Islam. Also, I think as a Muslim, you're not, it's so final, you have no right to change your religion if you decided to become, change your religion. So what does she feel about those? And
Manaz, we'll pick it up, and I thank you very much for your call. Asma Gul Hassan.
Well, I actually get similar questions from Muslim women all over the United States. I don't know if the caller is Muslim or not, but I think there's a real crisis among Muslim women in the world, and especially in the United States. There's this fear what does Islam really say? There's a fear among young Muslims in America to look at the Quran because there's this worry that what if the Quran does actually say these things? Mm-hmm. Then I'll have to say, why am I a Muslim? And many of those people have thanked me for writing my book because it's helped them revalidate their feelings. To specifically address the issues that she brought up, first we'll talk about polygamy. And I discuss this in my first book more, which is called American Muslims. In the Quran, it says that a man can have up to four wives. And Professor Ahmed may be able to speak about this more from a scholarly perspective. But it does say in the Quran that a man can have up to four wives. There are scholars who say that that was written for a specific time, specific place, when many men in the early Muslim community were being killed because of the civil wars that Muslims were caught up in, mm-hmm. and that some Muslims were at the center of sometimes. Another passage in the Quran says that a man must treat all four wives equally. And then yet another passage says it's impossible for a man to treat more than one wife equally. So one particular Islamic scholar, Fazl Rahman, who has died now, but was in America at the University of Chicago, was probably the foremost Islamic scholar in America at the time, said that, you know, the Quran was looking at polygamy as a social ill that, you know, cannot be changed overnight, but one that should be eventually resolved and eradicated. Clearly, you know, today I think polygamy is unacceptable.
In what frame, in what realm?
For me, I would not accept, you know, polygamy. I think it also does say in the Quran that a man must treat all four wives equally. And, you know, it's impossible to treat more than one wife equally. So, my message to the caller is that anytime I've come up against something that has bothered me about Islam, when I've explored it, when I've looked into it, I've come to a resolution that has worked for me and that I understand. I think the polygamy issue is one that, just as there are non-Muslims who have done propaganda against Muslims, negative PR on Muslims, polygamy is an issue that many Muslim men have done propaganda on.
Meaning
that they want to keep it because mm-hmm. it's something that benefits mm-hmm. men. Mm-hmm. There's apologies given by Muslim men that this is better than having mistresses. At least we marry them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's silly. I think that it is our right as Muslim women to speak up and say that, you know, that's incorrect to say that. And I, regardless of what you may think, I am not going to allow you to have more than one wife.
And the harsh punishment question that that Manaz raises?
Well, the Quran does have harsh punishments in it. We can't, you know, I'm not going to deny that. But there is a reason for it. And there's also specific requirements. In order to punish someone for adultery, and in the Quran, I believe the punishment is flogging, you have to produce four witnesses. And they have to be eyewitnesses to the sexual penetration of the adultery. So scholars say that when you look at this, you know, in effect, basically, no one was ever really supposed to get flogged because it's impossible to produce four witnesses. So then people say, well, why even have it in the Quran? Well, it's there to, I believe it's there to sort of say you can't be making accusations against people saying, oh, so-and-so is an adulterer, so-and-so said did this, did that. You know, we hear about Amina Lawal, the woman in, I believe, Nigeria,
right.
who was facing a punishment of stoning.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this, you know, resulted in much hue and cry about, you know, Islamic law requires stoning. And that actually bothered me. And I talk about this in my book that, you know, this Nigerian tribal court that was prosecuting her, they didn't even know that the Quran says the punishment for adultery is flogging, not stoning. Not that flogging is necessarily better. of course, that troubles
choice.
Me, too.
Take your pick. Leila Ahmed, what about it? We're hardly looking here tonight, given everything that we see and all the history that you cite, to put Islam on trial. Yet the question that you can feel it sort of incipient is, can we all get along? Is there a sufficient network of values that's shared that we can peacefully share the planet?
Yes, let me pick up on the issue of women, because I don't share Asma's rosy view, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think one of the luxuries we have in America is that we can be critical of things in which other countries women are not free to be critical of. That law is applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and I think one of the interesting questions that the
Mahnaz
raised was, well, is this your interpretation or is it an accepted interpretation? I think an interesting thing to think about is, I mean, I would define orthodoxy, for example. Orthodoxy does not share your views, and orthodoxy does do a lot of injustices to women. And if you define orthodoxy as belief plus power,
Belief plus power, as
yes,
in worldly power,
that's
earthly
right.
power.
Yeah, you have the power to say that your belief is, your interpretation of Islam is what counts. She doesn't have the power, nor do I. But there are people in the Muslim world who do. So,
of course, this is the same in all religions, is it
that's
not?
That's right, that's right. And that's exactly my point, because, you know, it's, and my sense of the Quran is actually rather different from Asma's. It's rather like the Bible, which has some things which are profoundly liberatory, whether about women or about the oppressed in general.
Fierce and scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And other things which are quite different and are much more repressive and clearly belong to another era.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that, and I think the Quran is exactly in the same way, that some things are very moving and very liberatory, and which is what traditionally, actually, Muslims have focused on. You know, if you go to church, as I sometimes do, I hear the loveliest parts of the New Testament quoted.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear lots of other things which are not so lovely. Mm. And that's exactly the same with the Quran. And there are people who home in on the negative and say this is what God requires.
Right.
And there are people who see it differently. So that debate has been there in Islam and is there. But who has the power to speak? And that is the key issue. And when you say, how are we going to live together? Well, I don't think we can live together with these awful fundamentalist people. So, and as I think I can't live together with fundamentalists anywhere.
Mm.
So I think you can live with the majority of Muslims who probably think as we do here, but don't have the power to either bomb anyone or to impose their belief. That's
so when you read Asma Gul Hassan's "Why I Am a Muslim," when you read her vision,
yes,
her interpretation, what she takes from the Quran as a young American Muslim, how do you see this? Is this a kind of grown up in the petri dish of liberal democracy? Does it represent the future? Is it relevant or irrelevant to the larger Islamic world? How do you interpret it?
Oh, I think there's no doubt it is relevant, because it's part of there are other books and other writers and people who are thinking like Asma today in America. And one of the key things, it's not that other people are not thinking it in other countries, you know. They are. But we have the freedom to speak and write here without being persecuted. So that's at least, on the whole, not being persecuted. Mm. So that's really the key element here. And I think eventually the Islam of Europe and America will filter back. And actually, I mean, it's not, as I said, it's not filtering back. That's a large part of how people think over there. But they don't really have the power to say it. So I think I've lost your question.
No, it's perfect. I just want to turn to Asma before we have to wrap up here. You write about mistaking cultural practices for Islamic ones, and you don't point fingers. You say lots of people do this, including many Muslims. Mm-hmm. What's your level of confidence that Islam, as you interpret it, which is it's a lovely thing, might become universal Islam? Or are you saying this is what it is already?
Well, for me, it's what it is already. And I think for many American Muslims, hopefully, inshallah, as Muslims say, Islam will see its great days again. You know, you keep referring throughout our interview that, you know, I paint this, you know, optimistic and sunny, and I don't think we've gotten much of a chance to talk about it. We focus more on the negative things to do with Islam.
Well, there's a tough world right now that
definitely,
we're looking at it against, but we hear your message within that.
Right, and I want, you know, non-Muslims to be able to read my book and finish it and say, I know why people are Muslim or would be Muslim in today's world. It's a natural question to ask with all these problems. But there are things in Islam, there are themes and values that, as Professor Ahmed was talking about, that are part of lived Islam that can comfort anyone, Muslim or non-Muslim.
Asma Gul Hassan, author of Why I Am a Muslim, An American Odyssey. It's been great having you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And Leila Ahmed, thanks for being with us again. Wonderful to have you.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Tom.
Leila Ahmed, professor of Women's Studies in Religion at the Harvard Divinity School. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.